the consolidated appeals in 20-1238, 20-1262, 20-1263, Colorado versus EPA. And we are ready to proceed when you are.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Jonathan Brightville from the United States Justice Department. Mr. Roper will speak for two of appellant's 15 minutes, and I will reserve two of my remaining 13 minutes for rebuttal. The district court erred by concluding that a famously fractured Supreme Court decision interpreting a famously ambiguous statutory provision addressing a materially different legal question than that which was presented by Colorado in its challenge below prohibits the agency's reasonable Chevron Step 2 interpretation of navigable waters, meaning waters of the United States. To the contrary, as another district court in San Francisco correctly recognized when denying a nationwide preliminary injunction based on the same arguments regarding the same rule, Colorado had no likelihood of success on the merits and hasn't. In fact, the district court below erred on each of the four elements of the winter preliminary injunction test, including irreparable harm, public interest, and the balance of harms. Now, on the likelihood of success element, the Supreme Court's Rapanos decision and its various opinions, whether the Scalia plurality, the Justice Kennedy concurrence, or the Justice Stevens dissent, are simply not addressing the legal question presented by the Navigable Waters Protection Rule. The Rapanos case was analyzing what the Clean Water Act says the agencies may regulate. How far can they reach? Can they regulate any hydrologically connected wetlands that can trace to the sea? But the Rapanos case was not addressing the legal issue relevant here. What the language of navigable waters requires that the statute must cover. So even if you assume the dissent were the holding of the Rapanos case, and it is not, it would still not bar the agency's adoption of the Navigable Waters Protection Rule, because the case is simply distinguishable. The dissent itself said all that they were doing in that case was looking to determine whether the agency's construction was reasonable. They weren't looking at how far the rule must go or the Clean Water Act must be read. Now, plaintiffs nevertheless seek to overturn the Navigable Water Protection Rule based on an implicit argument that they have to go farther. But that cannot be the teaching of Rapanos and the crisscrossing opinions, as Colorado argues. And in fact, even the district court inadvertently acknowledged the fallacy of its logic when it wrote in footnote 11 of its opinion, quote, "The problem for the agencies, unfortunately, is that Rapanos arguably forecloses every formulation of waters of the United States proposed in Rapanos or proposed by the agencies thus far. For example, eight justices rejected Justice Kennedy's case-by-case significant nexus report approach, the approach that Colorado is arguing that the agencies now should have to go back to and was the basis of the preliminary injunction. Your Honors, despite that bright red flag that something was really wrong with the logic of the district court's own argument, because really perverse consequences flowed from it, the district court still erroneously accepted Colorado's flawed theory. And that's because it failed to acknowledge that Rapanos is just flat out distinguishable legally on its face, no matter whose opinion controlled. Now, even if one presumes the Rapanos case opinions controlled the legal question presented by Colorado, which is how far must the agencies regulate, not how far they may regulate, the Supreme Court in Brand X and Chevron still recognizes agency authority to reinterpret statutes, notwithstanding contrary prior court decisions. So Brand X allows reinterpretation of a statute so long as the statutory language doesn't unambiguously bar the interpretation taken by an agency. And there's been no such agency here, or excuse me, Your Honor, there's been no such argument made here. The argument is that Rapanos somehow unambiguously bars this reading. So it was also error for the district court below to fail to apply Brand X to recognize that the agencies were entitled to reinterpret the statute, and a famously ambiguous statute, notwithstanding whether the Rapanos decision was controlling for its purpose, its legal holding, and its facts or not. Now, the interpretation of the Clean Water Act in the Navigable Waters Protection is reasonable, And we know that because the agencies actually thoughtfully harmonized key features of all of the various major opinions in the Rapanos decision. They used Justice Scalia's interpretation of navigable waters as a starting point, but the agencies also incorporated other features with a significant nexus to navigable waters in order to meet some of Justice Kennedy's issues. So going beyond the plurality decision and what the plurality would say is the appropriate reading of the of or a limit to the Clean Water Act, the agencies here actually included waters and wetlands that have a connection to navigable waters or perennial or intermittent tributaries at any point during a typical year, not simply a continuous surface water connection. They also included waters that are adjacent and only separated by natural berms or swales. Again, going beyond the Rapanos plurality. In this way, the agencies also responded to the primary criticism of the Rapanos dissent. Specifically, the dissent opined that the text might reasonably allow agencies to extend jurisdiction beyond a continuous surface water connection between a wetland and a creek. And again, the agencies did just that. Now, against this thoughtful interpretation of navigable waters in light of the Supreme Court precedent, including also the Swank decision, which definitively holds that there is a stopping point to the term navigable waters short of the Interstate Commerce Clause, Colorado points only to generalized objective provisions of the Clean Water Act and some scant legislative history. But the Supreme Court has repeatedly made clear, of course, that generalized policy provisions cannot be used by courts and litigants to negate the text of more specific implementing provisions. And in fact, in the Supreme Court's 1985 Riverside Bayview case, the Supreme Court specifically said, quote, neither of these sources, referring back to the legislative history and the objective provisions, quote, neither of these sources provides unambiguous guidance for the Corps, unquote, about how to interpret waters of the United States. And so those provisions can't be used to contradict and say that the Navigable Waters Protection Rule interpretation is unambiguously wrong, Your Honor. Moreover, the agencies have, consistent with those sources, given the term navigable waters, that's the term in the statute, waters, a broad reading consistent with the legislative history. The agencies have continued to extend Clean Water Act jurisdiction to include adjacent wet lands, not just the waters referenced by the plain text of the statute. So unless there are questions about that, I want to move on to the issues in with the irreparable harm finding. So under the Supreme Court's winter test, the Colorado had the burden to establish each of the four elements. But the only issue on which they found irreparable harm, this enforcement issue, had really significant evidentiary problems. Now, to be clear, the district court rejected all of the other theories of harm that were argued by Colorado on the record, including on the issue of the permitting gap. They rejected it because the inability to authorize projects was Colorado's own choice, their policy choice to make that paramount. They also relied on the fact that there was no evidence of projects in the imminent future. They also relied on the fact, the district court also relied on the fact that any such harm would be to developers, not to the state, which cannot sue parens patriae for developers. They also rejected, of course, that there would be any environmental harm given the existing Colorado authority that bars any discharges to any state waters. And very critically, the court looked at the baseline, which was to say that nothing about the Navigable Waters Protection Rule would make allegations that people might pollute contrary to the law any more or less likely as a result of that new rule. Therefore, there's no harm traceable to the Navigable Waters Protection Rule. Now, with respect to the one issue on which the district court did find irreparable harm and erred, this was done on a passing sentence of hearsay in one line of one declaration, and thereby a major federal regulatory problem, which a district court, in San Francisco, looked at all these same arguments and rejected. On that thin reed, it found irreparable harm. But in doing so, it jumped numerous evidentiary gaps in order to get to irreparable harm.
Well, let me interrupt for just a minute and clarify what the standard of review is. We're reviewing because the district court passed on the issue below, finding that this was raised. We're not looking at preservation, whether they raised it directly. We're looking at whether the district court abused its discretion in making the affirmative determination that this argument was raised, correct?
You're looking at both, Your Honor, but even accepting that the argument was sufficiently raised, and we think we think that this argument was not sufficiently flagged for there to have been an injunction as against a major regulatory program. There are still multiple evidentiary gaps that got jumped. Let me hit those real quickly. So even if you accept there are 3 to 5 federal enforcement actions, there is no evidence in the record that as to what federal regulatory enforcement policy is with respect to EPA enforcement actions, and whether that enforcement policy would ever have actions brought in the narrow, marginal, disputed waters between the navigable water protection rule and a significant nexus test. So the court just flat out assumed that, first of all, there would be as against that baseline, that there would be an incremental impact, which it, by the way, studiously and very carefully rejected in all of its other arguments, but missed the boat entirely here. But there was no evidence that federal regulatory enforcement policy regularly brings actions or ever brings such actions in these disputed waters. But secondly, even if you assume they did, the timing question that any such actions would not be brought in the gap, the period of time that would be necessary to adjudicate summary judgment versus having a preliminary injunction. And then one further evidentiary gap is that the failure to bring an enforcement action promptly would actually result in any irreparable harm to Colorado as Colorado, Your Honor. There is no such evidence. And so it could easily be the case that after the parties went to summary judgment and summary judgment was decided, that enforcement actions could be brought later at that time, utilizing the pre-existing law that will continue to be on the books, which in particular, under the state law, that state law was never changed and remains enforceable both by Colorado authorities and federal authorities, Your Honor. So there was no evidence of irreparable harm, even if you accept this theory on its face. So I wanted to reserve some time for rebuttal and Mr. Roper's time. So I'm gonna reserve at this time unless there are questions.
Okay, and with the consent of the panel, I'm going to be giving a little extra time on this case because of the complexity. So, to both sides. All right, thank you. You can reserve.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, and may it please the court.
Your Honor, if I could interrupt for a second. Are we setting 15 minutes for Mr. Roper separately from Mr. Brightbill? Or is he using the remaining 2 minutes and 30 seconds of Mr. Brightbill's time?
He's using the remaining 2:30 of Mr. Brightbill's time, but we'll give them some time on rebuttal that they can split however they decide on the fly right now.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. Glenn Roper on behalf of intervener appellants, the Sacketts. Our position in this case is simple. The revised definition of adjacent wetlands in the Navigable Waters Protection Rule is compelled by the Clean Water Act, as interpreted by the Supreme Court in Rapanos. With respect to adjacent wetlands, the Rapanos plurality would hold that directly abutting wetlands are regulable, but that non-abutting wetlands are not. In his concurrence, Justice Kennedy agreed that directly abutting wetlands are regulable, but he would also hold that non-abutting wetlands, like those that the EPA alleges are on the Sacketts property, may also be regulated in at least some circumstances. So under the 10th Circuit case law that we cite in our brief, the Rapanos plurality therefore provides the holding as to the issue of adjacent wetlands.
Well, let me interrupt there. In order to be the controlling holding under our case law, doesn't there have to be a subset? One opinion is a subset of the other. Do we have that here?
I think we do have a logical subset as to the issue of adjacent wetlands, because as Justice Kennedy recognized, all of the plurality's wetlands, all that would be encompassed by their test, was also encompassed by his test, but his test would also go broader and include additional wetlands. And so for that reason, the Navigable Water Protection Rule's reduction in regulation of adjacent wetlands is compelled by the statute, and it's not an exercise of agency.
Well, that you're making an assumption that any time you have abutting wetlands, that there's also a significant impact, right?
We would follow the plurality's decision, which is when you have. I think Justice Kennedy would, as a matter of law, conclude that there is a significant nexus, and the plurality concluded that when you have abutting wetlands such that they are indistinguishable, that you are going to have this connection such that it is appropriate to include the wetlands in the regulation. And if there are no further questions, we would ask the court to reverse the district court on the likelihood of success and vacate the stay as to the issue of adjacent wetlands.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Greg, would you go ahead and set the clock for 17 minutes so that I can give 2 minutes on rebuttal?
Good morning. May it please the court, Eric Olson on behalf of the state of Colorado.
Mr. Olson, would you wait for just a minute?
Sure.
The clock hasn't been set. There we go. Thank Great. You for your patience.
Thank you very much, Judge McHugh. Entering the stay here was well within the district court's discretion, and this court should not disturb it for three reasons. First, it is not reasonable under Chevron for agencies to define waters of the United States using a definition that five justices have rejected and is inconsistent with the Clean Water Act's text and purpose. Second, and independently, the agencies enacted the rule in violation of the Administrative Procedure Act, and the Corps of Engineers issued its rule in violation of the National Environmental Policy Act. Third, Colorado faces substantial irreparable harm if the rule goes into effect, and presented evidence of that harm to the district court. Turning first to the Rapanos decision, it makes clear the new rule is not reasonable under Chevron. The government, the business interveners, and Colorado all agree that we are in Chevron Step 2 territory, where we look, the agency must enact a rule that is reasonable, and it is not reasonable here because five members of the Supreme Court have said the rule cannot be as the government now claims it is. Because five justices have said the rule cannot be as the government now claims it is simply not reasonable for the agencies to enact that rule. And we know that when we look at the Rapanos decision itself. It says in the three key writings by Justice Scalia, Justice Kennedy, and Justice Stevens, that five of the justices said a reasonable interpretation of the Clean Water Act says that the floor must be navigable waters plus waters that have a significant nexus to those waters. And under that determination, the Corps and the EPA was not entitled to take the protection far below navigable waters plus waters with a significant nexus, which they have done in this rule.
When you're counting those votes, you're looking at the dissent also?
I'm looking at what each justice said, because we're not in Mark's territory for what's controlling, because we agree with Your Honor that there is no controlling decision there. But what we're looking at is each writing, and we're looking at the plurality opinion. Justice Scalia had four votes. Justice Kennedy spoke alone, and then Justice Stevens spoke in an opinion that was joined by four. And when you look at the totality of the opinion, it was five votes said that A, Chevron applies. Keep in mind, the plurality says Chevron doesn't apply, that the rule can mean and must only mean wetlands physically connected to relatively permanent and continuously flowing waters. Five said Chevron applies. And under Chevron, a reasonable rule, there's a lot of discretion for the agency, but it must include at least those waters that have a significant nexus when you look at the five. And it's no surprise based on that. This is not just sort of our theory here. Every court of appeals to have looked at this issue has concluded that the Clean Water Act must cover at least that as set forth by Justice Kennedy, the significant nexus test. And the Solicitor General of the United States recognized in a filing last year that fact, that every court of appeals to look at this has said the rule, the test from Rapanos is the significant nexus test. And so when you have that backdrop for the agencies to come in and adopt a much lower standard is simply not reasonable under the framework where we are.
Does it matter if Rapanos was looking at the furthest reach of the act and not what must be regulated? I mean, that's the argument on the other side, isn't it?
It is, and with respect to my friend's argument on the other side, the issue in Rapanos was not the furthest or what must be. It was the agency's definition of waters of the United States appropriate, legal, under the controlling law? And because of the posture of that case, the Justice Scalia's plurality opinion, which said it was not, joined by Justice Kennedy, which said it was not, in that particular case, they said that rule, specific rule, was not consistent with the agency's obligations. But if you took that same analytic framework and applied it to the rule at issue today, in other words, this rule was being challenged at the Supreme Court, and the question was it legal? We know what the outcome would be under the Rapanos decision, because Justice Kennedy would say, no, it is not, because it does not include a significant nexus. Justice Stevens and the three justices that joined him would say, no, it is not, because it is below the floor it sets it much too far below the floor when you read the opinion, so it would not be reasonable. So it was not, that question was not squarely presented. That is some advocacy by my friends to present the case saying it was different than it was. What was presented was that rule permissible? And the court and Rapanos said the rule at issue there was not permissible, and they gave different reasons for reaching that conclusion, which is why we have the 414 spread.
The question in Rapanos was, are they taking it too far by basically using the Migratory Bird Act interpretation, right?
No. The Migratory Bird Act was the Cook County case.
I'm sorry.
No. but the question in Rapanos was, is the definition consistent with the Clean Water Act of waters of the United States, consistent with the Clean Water Act? And the court said that definition was not. And the same too is the question that the district court was presented and we have in this case is this new rule consistent with the Clean Water Act? And we submit that under Chevron, where we all agree, the business interveners, the federal government, and Colorado agree we're in Chevron step two, that it's simply not reasonable to adopt different agencies to an adopt a rule that five justices have expressly rejected. Unless there's more questions on Rapanos, I would like to turn to the other theories that we have in this case, the Administrative Procedure Act and the National Environmental Policy Act.
Now, counsel, before we get into that detail, I want to be sure that we get into the question of irreparable harm and whether or not you're going to can win on this. I understand Rapano, I've read it and everything for its confusion and 414. Where are we as we go to the preliminary injunction? Where is this case if we reverse and say that there was no irreparable harm? Case, what happens to this case?
Well, we're required to show irreparable harm to obtain an injunction, and if you disagree with us, then we don't keep our injunction.
Okay, well, I know that. What I'm saying is, where are you? Where are the parties in this case if we say the court erred in granting a preliminary injunction? What's the status? Where's the case?
Well, the The substantive case would be ongoing. There's many, many challenges to this case across the country. So the case would be ongoing. All that's at issue here is a preliminary injunction or the APA 5 section 7005 power to stay the enforcement of the rule. Right now in Colorado, the old rule applies. If you find that we don't show irreparable harm, the new rule would apply in Colorado while we litigate the merits of the case below.
The effect of that is your own rule that you don't recognize any. Colorado has taken a real stringent requirement in that you're not going to fill in any wetlands or anything. We're not giving you any permit. But if the government grants you a permit, then we will recognize that permit until it ends or whatever it is. Now, I want to spend a little time before all your time on the irreparable harm. It appears to me that Colorado could correct this rule themselves real quick by adopting some provision, the legislature in the state of Colorado, by adopting some provision that gives them permissible or permitted requirements in regards to wetland. Now, why should you get a preliminary injunction on Colorado's own creation of where the law is in regard to this, because you have no laws?
Because for decades, Colorado has relied on the permitting process that is the federal government has administered and the Corps has administered under Section 404 for dredge and fill permits for decades, like 46, 45 other states. For them to drop the amount of water cut to less than 50% of the stream miles in Colorado is our estimate of what would no longer be covered. Without giving us the time, we absolutely agree, Judge Baldock, we could put in place a regulatory regime that could fill that gap, but we can't do that in 60 days, which is all that they gave us under the rule. And that's why we are irreparably harmed, because Colorado's legislature was not in session from the time the rule was issued to its effective date.
They purposely haven't been in session, isn't that right?
Well, Your Honor, our Constitution limits the number of days our legislature can be in session. And with COVID, those days have shrunk. That is correct. But importantly, we have not had an opportunity to fix this. In the notice, I think very telling what the federal government relies on in this reliance argument that we made in their reply brief at page 9, they point to page 9 to 11. They say, look, the references there say we recognize that it takes political capital and fiscal resources to change state law. But we are not going to speculate on what the government's going to, or state governments are going to do in response to this rule. But we acknowledge that Colorado has no permitting process. And so we submit that the harm from giving us 60 days to stand up a permitting process, when under the Colorado Constitution, our legislature wasn't even in session during that time. Now, we tried our level best to try to get something going, but we need legislative authority for that to happen. And that is arbitrary and capricious in our view and creates harm. Now, of course, if they gave us 12 months, this argument would be much, much weaker, because we would have the time and the ability to put up the resources to put that new permitting process in place. But when they drop the scope of waters by roughly 30%, the covered waters in Colorado from around 80% to 30% of the waters, and they don't give us time to put in a regulatory regime to fix that. And the permitting process is really important, because it's an information forcing rule. It requires polluters to come to us and say, we're gonna do this, here's how we're gonna minimize damage, here's how we're gonna put it back when we're done, and here's how we're gonna mitigate it elsewhere.
Without that— interrupt, Mr. Olson, that's not the basis of irreparable harm that the district court found, is it?
Correct.
The district court rejected that.
Correct. That is correct.
The court said that your irreparable harm is because you're going to have to divert state funds to create your own enforcement program, and that is what I call the enforcement burden on the state is the irreparable harm here.
Correct. And we submit they're two sides of the same coin, because the resources that we have to expend are much greater, because there is no permitting process. It's a difference between people coming to the government and say, I plan to do this, may I have permission, and us required, and this is the harm the district court found, for us to go out and find people over 30% of the waters that now are our waters and not the federal government waters, And rather than them come to us, we have to go to them. And that's the harm the district court found. And it's not an abuse of discretion.
Self-inflicted because of the Colorado approach, which is there will be no dredge and fill permits?
No, not at all, because we have relied on the EPA, the Corps of Engineers, excuse me, to administer that program like 45 other states for 20 or 30 some years. And so in the context of that substantial reliance for a tremendous amount of time, it is not unreasonable for Colorado to not have a backup permitting process at the go in the event that the rule changes. We submitted in April 2019 our comments to this proposed rule and said exactly this, that we don't have a permitting process and it would cause harm to us for it to be implemented. It takes time for state laws to change. And the government, when they issued the rule in April of 2020, again, gave us 60 days, which was under any fair reading of our statutory provision was not permissible. And
let me again interrupt because it's hard to get in there because you keep talking. I think the response was, well, you've known since the executive order was signed here. I mean, you know, there was an executive order changed the rule and make it comply with Justice Scalia's opinion. Isn't that fair notice?
We have been on notice. No, it is not. We have been on notice that they're going to change the rule several times. But until the final rule was issued was the first indication that we had made the comment about state enforcement and that that comment did not lead to a change in the policy. So we did not know the rule was going to change until April of this year. I do also want to briefly address the two other causes of action, the National Environmental Policy Act and the Administrative Procedure Act, briefly, if I may. The district court did not address these. And this court has its the option of addressing it itself, and we believe for the reasons stated in the brief, both the APA and NEPA against the Corps violate it, or it could send it back to the district court for additional work. We would just respectfully request that if it does send it back to the district court to address in the first instance, that the court do what it did in Rutherford v. United States, which is use the authority under 5 USC 705, which was the basis of the district court's stay here, to keep the stay in place, keep the status quo in place in Colorado while the district court addresses those issues. And just like to make one last point on irreparable harm. The government spends a lot of time talking about the gaps in our evidence, but they had an opportunity to present evidence to the district court of how the federal enforcement worked. They knew our arguments. We submitted declarations from state state folks that administer this, including Ms. Rowan, who talked about the harm from enforcement. The government never responded with evidence. So the district court ruled on what it had before it, and the government had a chance, an opportunity to make those arguments using facts rather than after the fact legal arguments, and they chose not to do so. And we think that would be a very unfair basis.
Counsel, I've got to ask you this question. Then who has the burden to show the harm? That's you, isn't it?
We have the burden of showing harm. We showed up in district court with evidence, if I may answer. And the government did not present evidence going the other direction, even though they had a full opportunity to do so. So we don't think it's fair for us to present evidence and the government not to present evidence, and then them to say now our evidence is deficient or not enough. It was a factual inquiry. And the government chose not to present evidence. And they, of course, can come and say what we showed wasn't enough. But for them to say that what we showed has all these holes and gaps about their conduct, and they chose not to present any evidence, is a step too far from our perspective.
Thank you. You're out of time.
Thank you very much.
All right. And there's 2 minutes on rebuttal. Mr. Brightbill, are you handling that? And you're muted, just so you know.
Yes, I am, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor. I actually think that argument by Mr. Olson is really disingenuous. The final preliminary injunction was filed on June 1st, 2020. We had to respond on an expedited basis by June 8th, 2020. The court ruled on June 19th, 2020. So this was at lightning speed. We were limited to 22 pages to address all the issues. They have the burden to present evidence to meet all four winter factors. They did not do so. We did cite evidence to the record that the court could take judicial notice of the many aspects of the administrative record. Now, well, with all due respect to my colleague, everybody needs to reread Rapanos, because the question in Rapanos was what was about two properties, and whether those two properties, whether the Corps had properly asserted Clean Water Act jurisdiction over those two properties, and whether those constituted adjacent wetlands. And so the question was, can you reach those? May you reach those? Four justices said, absolutely not, prohibited by the plain text of the statute. One justice said, maybe, maybe not, need more evidence. And four justices said merely that it was reasonable to read the act that far. That was all the farther that those four justices went, not with all due respect that they must reach that, or that we must reach adjacent wetlands. And that's in the Rapanos decision at 126 Supreme Court 2263, quote, for quoting from the dissent, in any event, the proper question is not how the plurality would define adjacent, but whether the court's definition is reasonable. And they went on to say the definition is plainly reasonable, both on its face and in terms of the purposes of the act, Your Honor. So they were not holding that this unambiguously required that the statute must reach those wetlands or other similar wetlands. It's an open, novel question. Now, on the irreparable harm, they also say they only had 60 days. As Your Honor pointed out, they had all kinds of notice, and this was an argument that was made to and rejected by the district court. And that rejection of that argument gets reviewed for clear error, and there is not clear error here that they had ample notice and opportunity to change directions if they wanted to, but did not, Your Honor. Unless the court has further questions, I see I'm out of time.
You are. Thank you for your argument today. We will take this under advisement.